Because I also don't believe in truth in advertising, I'm going to beg your indulgence and propose that I dwell on some of the specifics of what is happening in Israel vis-a-vis Gaza. As Talia mentioned earlier, I was there throughout the war and its conclusion and spent some time talking with some senior decision makers there, including the Prime Minister designate, but that may be more productive to discuss in detail. So what I wanted to propose for my remarks is to talk about what the Obama administration ought to do in the 4 or 8 years ahead as it looks at the various problems and challenges it confronts vis-a-vis Israel, vis-a-vis the Middle East at large. And I was thinking that maybe I should offer it as a roadmap, but the term roadmap leaves a bit of a bitter taste in my mouth. And also it tends to be the case, particularly in foreign policy, that there is no roadmap that isn't immediately overwhelmed by what Harold Macmillan, the one-time British Prime Minister, called events. He said, what worried him most as Prime Minister? He said famously, events, dear boy, events. And in fact, if I had a wish for the Obama administration, for Hillary Clinton, I'd love to see Hillary Clinton walking around in a t-shirt saying, events happen. If any of you are in the business, you can print these t-shirts up. So instead of talking about a roadmap, what I wanted to do is offer a series of commandments, if you will. I don't propose to give 10 commandments because, contrary to what my mother believes, mine is not, in fact, the word of God. But let me suggest 6 or 7 or 8 commandments that I think could serve the Obama administration well in the years ahead if it is mindful of them. I would say that the first commandment for President Obama and for Hillary Clinton is, thou shalt not succumb to the lure of the so-called inevitable. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that when we look at the Middle East, and particularly when some of my colleagues in the so-called foreign policy establishment look at the challenges in the Middle East, there is a tendency to assume that certain things are inevitable, and the best way to deal with them is simply to accept them as facts rather than to challenge them. And the first great inevitability that you now hear addressed or described or discussed more and more often is the inevitability of Iran becoming a nuclear weapons state. I have been giving speeches now for several years warning that Iran is on the cusp of becoming a nuclear weapons state. And as I give these speeches or write columns and op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, for a number of years the kind of smart talk was that Iran wasn't going to get a nuclear weapon for until the year 2012 or 2015, the horizon kept being pushed further and further away. It seems clear now, not only by the estimates of the United States and of Israel, but also by the UN's own International Atomic Energy Agency, which is not, in fact, chaired by Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, that Iran has, in fact, already crossed the nuclear threshold. Just the week before last, we learned that Iran has enriched over 1,000 kilograms of uranium, low-enriched uranium, that is sufficient with further enrichment to manufacture at least one atomic bomb. We learned also from the IAEA's report that they had underreported the amount of enriched uranium in their possession by about 460 pounds. We learned that they continue to make progress on what is known as a heavy water plant in the town or in the city of Arak. A heavy water nuclear plant has one purpose and one purpose only, which is to manufacture weapons-grade plutonium. We also learned last week, or rather the Iranians announced, that they're going to begin testing on their ostensibly civilian nuclear reactor being built for them courtesy of our good friend Vladimir Putin in the town of Bushehr. As I said, people speak of this as a civilian nuclear reactor, but the plain fact is, and any nuclear scientist will tell you, that after about a year or so of operation, this plant will produce sufficient quantities of spent fuel that can easily and covertly be reprocessed into weapons usable plutonium. So Iran is progressing swiftly and capably and in a determined way on not one front but three to acquire a nuclear weapons capability, and they are crossing that threshold as we speak. And as they do so, the intelligent commentary, or I should say in quotation marks, the intelligent commentary argues that the price of stopping Iran is really too great a price for us, imposes costs that we can't bear, and that we would be well served living with a nuclear Iran as we live with other nuclear weapon states like a nuclear Pakistan. I'll get to the issue of a nuclear Pakistan, this disintegrating country with 100 or so nuclear weapons in a few minutes, but that is the argument that is made. We will be able to contain a nuclear Iran, that it is a rational state, that it will use its weapons or will not use its weapons, and that they will sort of fit into the nuclear proliferation pattern in the way that, say, Great Britain and France do. This is a very serious mistake, and people need to take cognizance of it. Even if you accept the argument, which I do not for one second, that either the United States or Europe, much less Israel, can live with Iran in possession of nuclear weapons, you also ought to be honest enough to admit that an Iran with nuclear weapons will soon mean a Saudi Arabia with nuclear weapons, because the regime that sees itself as the great guardian of the Sunni establishment will not live with a nuclear Iran near its borders. And if that's the case, then the Egyptians, who have already been covertly experimenting with nuclear technologies, will also not sit still for a nuclear Iran. And if that's the case, the Turks, whose government is increasingly hostile to the United States, hostile to Israel, and friendly to Iran, will also not sit still. So instead of looking at a Middle East with one or two or three nuclear powers, you will be looking at a Middle East with five or six or seven. And these are states which, let me understate, are not stable, responsible governments. So even if you are not a neoconservative or someone who's concerned about the character of the regimes, if you're a simple foreign policy realist, you will have to understand that to declare Iran's nuclear ambitions as unstoppable and inevitable is to accede to an apocalyptic scenario throughout the Middle East. So we should not, that is the first commandment, do not succumb to that temptation. And in the same vein of not succumbing to the belief that it's inevitable, we should not succumb to the belief that because Hamas is in power in Gaza, we need to negotiate with it, we need to find a way to talk to them. This too is a mistake. If you are someone who believes in a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians, then surely you cannot then say, well, in fact, let's have a three-state solution involving Israel, Fatah in the West Bank, and Hamas in Gaza. That is itself illogical. It does not help moderates in the Palestinian community, to the extent that there are moderates there, to empower Hamas and legitimize Hamas by recognizing it as the sovereign de facto government of half of the Palestinian community. And it certainly doesn't help. It doesn't help the case if Hamas gains that legitimacy and then seeks to contest Palestinian elections if and when they will occur, because that will only make it that much more certain that Hamas, whose charter is not only explicitly calls for the destruction of Israel, but is explicitly anti-Semitic and calls for the killing of Jews, that Hamas will become the sovereign and premier power within the Palestinian community. And that, too, is a nightmare scenario. And it's one in where we simply can't say, well, there's nothing we can do about it, or nothing, none of the options seem particularly palatable, so we're just going to accept it. So that's the first commandment. Don't succumb to the temptations of the inevitable. The second one, I would say, is don't succumb to the temptation of negotiation for the sake of negotiation. I'm not hostile to the idea of negotiations when there is some prospect that they will achieve some desirable end for the purposes of American foreign policy, or when Israel is concerned, for the purposes of Israeli foreign policy. Negotiation in itself is simply a tool of statecraft like any other tool. But it is foolish to think that we ought to negotiate because that's what, you know, diplomats are supposed to do. So we will embark on negotiations with the Palestinians, we will embark on negotiations with the Syrians, we will embark on negotiations with the Iranians. The European Union has been negotiating with Iran for the past 5.5 years over its nuclear dossier. And the only thing that has been achieved is hilarity. That actually expresses my point perfectly, because the 5 years of negotiation have been something of a colossal joke. The thing that is worrisome about them is that what the negotiations offered Iran was the opportunity to play for time. In 2003, they were years away from achieving a nuclear capability. Now they are months away from achieving one. That's one of the pitfalls of negotiation. In the case of the Syrians, never mind that Israel began negotiating with the Syrians in 1991. Never mind that it's already been 15 years since the Rabin government of the early 90s offered to return the Golan Heights very nearly in its entirety to Hafez Assad, an offer that was summarily rejected. Never mind that Hafez Assad's son, Bashar Assad, is more militantly anti-Israel than his father was, more militantly pro-Hezbollah, and has deepened his ties with the Iranians. To embark on a negotiation with the Syrians now is to flatly ignore the experience of the past 18 years of attempts to come to terms with the Syrians. More dangerously, to negotiate with them allows the Assad regime to get away with the murder of the former Lebanese Prime Minister, Rafiq Hariri, to escape the consequences of the tribunal, to consolidate its de facto rule in Lebanon, and if they succeed, to get the Golan Heights in the bargain. For what exactly would Israel get in return for that kind of negotiation? That seems to me a temptation that we ought to resist. And finally, it's absolutely important to negotiate with the Palestinians. But let's be serious about who we're negotiating with and whether the partner we see on the other side is going to remain in power, is going to be able to deliver a deal, and is going to honor that deal if and when it is implemented. Those are thoughts that need to be considered. It's always nice to feel that you're at the diplomatic table, that you're making progress. But 7 years of intensive and sincere efforts by the Clinton administration through the Oslo Accords, resulted in nothing except a 5-year intifada and the death of thousands of Israelis and Palestinians. The third point I would make is thou shalt not forget human rights activists and supporters of democracy in Middle Eastern states. Democracy promotion somehow acquired a bad name with the Bush administration, and to some extent, it acquired that bad name on account of mistakes of the Bush administration. Above all, allowing Hamas to participate in an election in the Palestinian Authority when Hamas did not recognize the legal basis through which those elections were being held. That election in the Palestinian Authority happened. In fact, the Palestinian Authority itself happened on the basis of the Oslo Accords, which came about when the PLO, in the name of the Palestinians, recognized Israel's right to exist. Hamas never recognized the Oslo Accords, and for both Israel and the Bush administration to therefore allow a party which doesn't accept the constitutional basis of the elections that they were contesting was the height of folly. And that has given democracy a black eye in the Middle East. People, all the same, should take note of the election which just took place in Iraq, in which the sectarian and religious parties were trounced, and in which people voted overwhelmingly for secular parties and voted overwhelmingly against parties that had connections to Iran. Democracy sometimes produces bad results. Anyone who has voted for a losing candidate knows that feeling. And anyone who has seen the experience of democratic governments over decades ought to understand that well. But that does not discredit the principle. And there are, believe it or not, especially now that I travel extensively in places like Pakistan and Egypt and Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, believe it or not, if you scratch the surface of Middle Eastern societies, of Arab and Muslim societies, if you decide as a journalist you're not going to interview Hanan Ashrawi for the 72nd time or Saya Barakat so you can hear the mantra about occupation repeated ad nauseum, if you actually go and talk to Egyptians and Palestinians and Lebanese and Syrians and you get to what they'd like to tell you, and you're slightly mindful that they're not speaking as we do in a free society, but with the constraints and the fears of speaking in an authoritarian society, you will realize that there's a considerable hunger in these countries for a politics which takes them in a more liberal, progressive, desirable, tolerant direction. It's not universal. I don't want to say that this is a kind of Nixonian silent majority in the Middle East, but it's there, and these people are courageous, and they ought to be defended, and they ought to be cultivated, and they ought to be protected by the United States. And that's a policy that's worth honoring. It honors our principles, it honors theirs. Next point, thou shalt not forget about Egypt and Pakistan. This doesn't exactly sound worthy of Moses, especially on the Egyptian point. Well, we do remember Egypt, but not in a good way. If you were to ask me, and you heard what I just said about Iran, and I'll have a couple more things to say about it in a moment, but if you were to ask me what I think is the most worrisome foreign policy crisis immediately confronting the Obama administration, it is what seems maybe the impending collapse of Pakistan. Unlike Iran, Pakistan is a nuclear weapons state. It has between 100 and 200 deliverable nuclear warheads. It has figured out the technology of marrying these warheads to ballistic missiles, which can go a great distance. If you've been following the course of events in recent weeks, you have seen that not just the remote tribal areas bordering Afghanistan, but increasingly central areas in Pakistan, the Malakand district, the Swat Valley, have fallen under the control of religious fanatics and people connected to the Taliban. In the government of the current president, Asif Ali Zardari, you have one of the most corrupt and incompetent governments that Pakistan has ever had. His only other quasi-secular opposition, a man named Nawaz Sharif, is even worse. Now, the way it's usually played in Pakistan is you get corrupt civilian governments and they're shortly replaced by somewhat less corrupt but more heavy-handed military governments, and that may yet happen in Pakistan. But what we are seeing in that country is the Talibanization not simply of the frontier areas with Afghanistan, but of the country itself. And the Taliban will shortly realize, if it hasn't already, that its best defense is to insert itself not in remote cities like Quetta and Peshawar, but in Karachi and Lahore and Rawalpindi, the Pakistani heartland. And once they do that, confronting them, rooting them out, and defeating them is going to be a virtually impossible task. And this administration has to think very seriously, never mind an Afghan policy. The center of this war is not in Afghanistan. The center of this war now, the great prize, is in Pakistan, and people have to start thinking very seriously about what are the options for the United States in ensuring, first, that Pakistan does not fall, and secondly, if there's some risk of it falling, how do you secure its nuclear weapons, its capabilities? The other thing that I mentioned, Egypt. This is something that we ought to think about very seriously. Egypt has not been thought of as a foreign policy problem for over 30 years, ever since Begin and Sadat signed the peace treaty in 1979. But you now have, as president of Egypt, an octogenarian. He's not going to be around forever, and there's going to be a crisis of succession in that country. And it's not at all clear that his successor will honor the treaty commitments with Israel, or will be interested in maintaining a strategic alliance with the United States that, on account of the financial crises, he perceives to be increasingly unreliable and weak. So what might the next Egyptian leader do if he's not himself from the Muslim Brotherhood? The likeliest thing that he would do is try to establish a kind of power-sharing deal with the Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood is nothing but the parent organization of Hamas. So it would essentially create a Hamastan, not just in the Gaza Strip, but throughout Egypt, the largest and by far the most powerful Egyptian state. America may be, vis-a-vis Egypt, where we were vis-a-vis Iran in 1977. I'm sure some of you will remember in, 77 or 78, Jimmy Carter went to Tehran and toasted the Shah as a pillar of stability in the region. Within a year, Khomeini had arrived, and Iran went from being an anchor, an American anchor in the Middle East, to being our most inveterate and dangerous enemy in the region. And we may be confronting that situation soon with Egypt. So it's important to start thinking seriously about what we do about Egypt, particularly when there is a succession. Fifth point, and this takes me back to speaking about Iran, and that is thou shalt take the Iranian regime at its word. Now, people will often say that when Ahmadinejad says, you know, let's wipe Israel off the map, or Israel's days are numbered. There have been a number of translations and debates about exactly what it is he said, but I think the general gist of his communiques have been clear. Again, you often hear the argument in places like the Council on Foreign Relations that you ought to discount that kind of furious, millenarian, anti-Semitic rhetoric. I think that's a fundamental mistake, and I think it's a fundamental misreading of what Iran is. In my view, Iran is not simply Persia. Iran is not simply a nation state. Iran is a revolutionary power. It operates not so much on the classic nation state model. It operates much as other revolutionary powers did in the past. Napoleonic France, for example, Hitlerite Germany, and communist Russia, and to a somewhat lesser extent, China. And to give you a sense of what I mean by this, the Germany that invaded France in 1914 was an authoritarian, militaristic, chauvinistic country. But it wasn't bent on world domination. It wasn't bent on reshaping the world in the perverted image and ideology of its leadership. The Germany that invaded France in 1940 was bent on reshaping the world in this perverted, in this perverted Aryanized image. There is a fundamental difference between those two Germanies, and I would submit that the Iran that we confront today is closer. I don't want to be accused of saying, well, this Iran is simply a Nazi regime. There are obvious differences. But it is, in its spirit and its ambition, much closer to the Germany of 1940 than it is to the Germany of 1914. And that's a distinction people ought to be aware of. Iran sees itself as a great player on a world historic stage, not simply as a regional player vying for advantage in a circumscribed part of the world. So that needs to be taken into account. On the whole, when people say scary things like that, they actually mean it. Next, and I'm coming to the end of this list of commandments, thou shalt not let the name of Israel and the name of the Jews be traduced. And I think this is very important. Traduced, violated, defamed. You know, one of the things I find extraordinarily frustrating when I have discussions about criticism of Israel, anti-Zionism, and anti-Semitism is that you find, and I'll say this frankly, particularly in among Jewish conversations, you'll find an incredible kind of almost Talmudic hair splitting about, well, that's not quite anti-Semitism, it's really anti-Zionism. You know, it's there are distinctions that we don't want to accuse so-and-so of actually being an anti-Semite. That's an ugly charge to level, and so on. So there's a fair... When we talk about who is an anti-Semite, I think we as Jews tend to set the bar pretty high. We accept all kinds of stuff that is said. We accept all kinds of travesties about Israel. We sort of shrug indignantly at what we read in newspapers. Fortunately, not everyone does, not least camera. But we do this, and I was thinking, you know, a few years ago, Rush Limbaugh made some comment. I didn't even hear it, but he made some comment on, I think, on ESPN, and I think it had to do with a black quarterback, and the gist of, as I heard it, the gist of the comment was that the quarterback had essentially he shouldn't have been sort of the starting quarterback or something, and he was only that because he was the first black quarterback, some kind of comment like that. He was hounded out of ESPN. People said, this is unacceptable. Now, my point here isn't to trash Rush Limbaugh or even make a point about the justice of that decision, but it is important to note that when we talk about racist or potentially racist comments in this country, the taboos are very firm, the bar is set very low, and African Americans have made it very clear that they, as a community, will not be traduced. They will not tolerate bigotry or hints of bigotry. And I think there's a lesson actually to be learned for Jews in precisely that attitude. We need to start being considerably less tolerant about anti-Semitism, less minutely discriminating about who is an anti-Semite and who is an anti-Zionist. It was Martin Luther King who said explicitly in 1967, don't tell me that anti-Zionism isn't anti-Semitism. It was Martin Luther King who said that. I think that is at least one convincing authority on the subject. There is a tidal wave of anti-Semitism that is sweeping the world today. It is not simply relegated to fringe corners. It's not simply relegated to Islamist websites. It is ubiquitous in Europe, and I fear it is going to become ubiquitous in the United States through a combination of the policies that Israel may have to pursue in the Middle East for its own security, through the financial crisis, which invariably is going to be blamed in many quarters on Jews, and through the persistence in history of Jew hatred, because anti-Semitism is itself merely a form of Jew hatred, that this is a tidal wave that is going to descend on us soon. And we have to make it clear, as I said, our names will not be traduced. We will not accept some kind of prevalent level of low-grade anti-Semitism, because that tide is only going to rise. Finally, last commandment, and this is a positive commandment. We need to start making a much better case for Israel. And that's not simply a matter of substituting one spokesman for the IDF or for the Israeli foreign ministry with another, or sharpening our editorial pens. We need to start thinking about the total case for Israel. And maybe because this is the era of the Obama administration, let me say this. Look, I come from the Wall Street Journal. You know the politics of the editorial page that I represent. It's very easy to make the right-wing case for Israel. It's very easy to make the conservative case for Israel. It is very easy to make the Christian case for Israel, not that I entirely understand it. Jews occasionally make the case for Israel, and that's always delightful when that happens. The case for Israel that urgently needs to be made forcefully today is neither conservative nor Christian nor ethnically specifically Jewish. It is the liberal case for Israel. Because the fact is that the main thrust of criticism against Israel is coming principally from the left. And maybe some of you have heard me say this before, but particularly when I speak on college campuses and you see, you know, you're not in that sense preaching to the converted, so to speak, or in this case, the unconverted. You're talking to young people who have not made up their minds and whose sympathies and instincts tend to lie with the perceived underdog, with the Palestinians, with the Arabs. And I will say to them, I will ask, how many of you believe that gay people should be able to live in freedom and free from fear and in dignity, that they should be able to pursue the careers of their choice, that they should be able to serve in government, and in fact, that they should be able to serve openly and with honor in the military? And all hands go up. Terrific, I say. How many of you believe that women should be able to pursue the careers that they want, that they should be able to choose the spouses that they want, that they should have available to them all of the kinds of choices and opportunities that women have now in the United States and in the advanced countries of the West? Again, all hands go up. Terrific. Next question. How many of you believe that journalists ought to be able to practice their trade and not fear consequences from the government? That they should be able to expose corruption at the highest levels, that they should be able to criticize and savagely criticize the policies of their government? Again, all hands go up. Wonderful. How many of you are opposed to the death penalty? Most hands go up. And so forth and so on. How many of you, I should add, believe that ethnic minorities ought to be represented in parliaments and in government? How many of you believe that if you're accused of a crime, you should have access to a competent judiciary and a fair trial? All hands go up. The point I'm making, which I hope is obvious, is that the only country in the Middle East which has consistently defended and practiced these values through a 60-year existence, which has been, in the main, an existence lived in a state of emergency, is Israel. And I say to them, and I'll say this to you tonight, that is the crux of the issue. We can talk about settlements, we can talk about occupation, we can talk about this or that Israeli policy till our faces turn blue. But on this core point, which is, do you, who have accepted all of the propositions that I have offered, will you then tell me that you, having accepted all of that, reject Israel's right to exist? Reject the basic argument for Israel. If you reject it, you are guilty of a fundamental hypocrisy. This is the argument that needs to be advanced, especially on college campuses, in conversations with your friends and with your intellectual sparring partners. Again, it's not the conservative case for Israel. It's not the strategic case for Israel. It's the liberal case for Israel. We need to start making it. We need to start making it now, and we need to start making it aggressively. We are living in years of decision. And these are, I think, every bit as significant as more than several generations ago, the years of decision of the 1930s. And the decisions we make now are going to have real consequences. And I'll close with one final Talmudic dispensation, if I may. There's a story of Moshe, who constantly goes to shul, and you know, especially when no one's around, and he prays and prays and prays, and he says, "God, please let me win the lottery. Just please let me win the lottery." This goes on for years. No, you know, he just doesn't win the lottery, and it goes on forever and ever. And finally, you know, late one night, there he is praying fervently. And this voice booms out from, you know, the depths. And the voice says, "Moshe, do me a favor, buy a ticket." I'll conclude by saying to everyone, thank you for coming, and please buy a ticket.
First of all,
I guess you fixed your problem there.
Clearly did. There's no echo at least.
Okay. Are we there? All right. That's what Moshe heard. So, thank you for a wonderful presentation. I can't say it was an uplifting presentation.
I saved that for you.
Right. Thank you. As I have it in my notes here, there's no threat posed by the state of Rhode Island, and that's about it. Otherwise, there's no place that we can go that we don't. And I want to start, actually, I want to start with Pakistan. And ask you about the argument of Fareed Zakaria, who says that the Taliban are very bad guys, but they don't export their badness. That is, unlike Al-Qaeda, you don't have Taliban soldiers in other countries seeking to spread Talibanism, and that because we have limited resources, and because it is so difficult to fight people in their own countries, that we have to try to target those groups that export their evil, as opposed to going after groups that are evil in their own circumscribed area. So what would you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, that article became the cover of Newsweek, which was more of a comment on Newsweek than anything else I've seen recently. Look, it's a profoundly fatuous argument, not least because it was the Taliban that harbored al-Qaeda and gave it the sanctuary it needed in order to strike on September 11th. And so it is simply, I mean, from the start, the argument that they pose no threat except to, the girls' schools they blow up, or the civil servants they behead, or all these other things that otherwise they're perfectly kosher and harmless, is a bizarre one. Now, obviously, a state which has limited, and in the case of the United States, increasingly limited resources, has to be relatively selective about whom we choose to go after. And we don't...
I'll ask questions and you can then address your answers to them, so...
sorry. I mean, for example, the Tamil Tigers, we haven't invested
them, right.
Millions of dollars. But the argument is sort of doubly fatuous, with all respect to Fareed, because in Iraq, we've already made it clear that we can distinguish between Islamists whom we have to deal with, whose values we may not approve of, but who are potential allies. And that was the whole essence of why the surge succeeded, because we were able to peel away these Sunni tribes away from the grip of al-Qaeda. We peeled them. It was a kind of a push and pull type of a situation. But it is, that being said, speaking specifically about the Taliban, the argument is simply wrong, because what the Taliban now threatens to do, even if it isn't training pilots to be sent into buildings in Los Angeles, what it is clearly attempting to do is to take over Pakistan as a state, to replace, in effect, Afghanistan with Pakistan. And it does not seem to me that a regime which gave sanctuary to al-Qaeda in Afghanistan should be allowed to gain power in Pakistan, where they could then offer sanctuary to groups like al-Qaeda, which might have other ideas about what to use, what uses to make of their nuclear arsenal. So that was,
I want to bring it around to Israel in a minute, but as long as we're on Pakistan, what role does India have in this? It seems to me that India is increasingly important as not only bordering Pakistan, but as a Hindu but minority Muslim state.
Well, I mean, India's a discussion that could take us on. We could spend all night on it, but just for our purposes.
Give us your abbreviated India.
Look, clearly, let me just back up one second. When we speak about the Taliban, that's not a very precise way of speaking, because there's the Taliban, there's groups like Haqqani and Hekmatyar, and they're sort of Taliban. Let's just speak of sort of Islamists in the Pakistani context, which includes the Taliban, but it would also include groups like Lashkar-e-Toiba, which has a Kashmiri focus. These groups have rivalries within them, but they're increasingly allies in their overarching goal, which is to seize power in Islamabad. One of the ways they think they might be able to do so is by a series of spectacular terrorist attacks in India that would cause a Pakistani-Indian war, which Pakistan would lose, breaking the back of the Pakistan army and creating access for the Taliban then to take over Pakistan. That was the entire purpose of the attacks in Mumbai. It was to elicit a furious Indian retaliatory response against Pakistan. To India's great credit, they showed enormous restraint in not responding to what was clearly a Pakistani provocation. But the LET is going to try it again. And there was, I mean, this happened in New Delhi 4 or 5 years ago, happened in Mumbai last November. It might happen sometime this year. The most important thing India can do is to continue to show restraint while it builds up its own internal institutions. I mean, one of the things we found out in Mumbai is what a shambles their internal security mechanisms are, and they're going to have to work on those, to develop those massively to guarantee some greater form of domestic security.
In the most recent Commentary magazine on your newsstands now, Brett Stevens has an article about Syria and why the Obama administration should resist the impulse to open negotiations with Syria. Also, by the way, as long as he's here, and I mentioned the most recent Commentary magazine, our own Rick Richmond has an article in that magazine about the New York Times coverage. Yes, you can applaud him. About the New York Times coverage of Gaza. That is also worth your time. But why? What should Israel not do, and the Obama administration not do with Syria, and what ought they do?
Look, the Hippocratic Oath specifies, first of all, do no harm, and that's that. I would say would be the policy. What they should not do is they should not engage in feckless, as I mentioned in my speech, in a feckless diplomatic overture that will consolidate Bashar Assad's power while asking him to surrender nothing in return. Because what you're doing is, number one, rewarding his bad faith, number two, letting him off the hook for the murder of Rafiq Hariri, number three, giving him no incentive to disentangle Syria from Lebanon or to distance himself from Hezbollah, and also there's a very limited prospect that the Syrian-Iranian axis will ever be dissolved. You know, again, this is, I mean, I'm sometimes sort of astonished by things that ostensibly serious foreign policy commentators say. They'll say, well, the Syrian-Iranian alliance is unnatural because, after all, the Syrians are Sunnis and the Iranians are Shiites, and Sunnis and Shiites, you know, can't possibly cooperate, neglecting the fact that the regime, Assad's regime, is an Alawite regime, which is, if anything, closer to Shiism than not, and that has had its own bloody history with Sunni elements in Syria going back to the Hama massacre in 1982. So that alliance is not going to be disentangled. If we invest huge amounts of diplomatic capital, in the worst case scenario, you get what you think you want, which is Israel relinquishes the Golan Heights and gets no real peace, no real recognition, but significantly exposes itself on yet another front to a hostile power. So the first thing I would say is to do no harm. The second thing is, I mean, look, there is a legitimate case to be made that if you get rid of the Assad regime, it will be replaced by some version of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's not something to be desired. Although, I would say that would be the fastest way to end the Syrian-Iranian axis, which we worry so much about. So what I think has to happen in Syria is essentially a policy amounting to a kind of containment, to punish misdeeds, to maintain sanctions on the country, to make sure that it is considered an outlaw state. This has been the policy of the United States for many, many years, and it's not an ideal, it doesn't produce an ideal outcome, but among the alternatives, it strikes me as the soundest of the alternatives.
Let's turn our attention to Gaza and to internal Israeli affairs for a minute. First of all, as rockets begin to come again over the border, I don't know that it's fair to speak of wars as successes or failures, but do you think the Gaza effort was worthy and well enough done that you're glad that they undertook it?
Well, as Zhou Enlai said about the French Revolution, it's too soon to tell.
We'd be happy to invite you back.
I'd be happy to come back. But look, just after the ceasefire, I interviewed Netanyahu, and he made a point which I thought was sound. He said that the minimal outcome of the war ought to have been to seal Gaza. The optimal outcome ought to have been to get rid of Hamas as the governing authority. It seems that neither has been achieved, which at least initially indicates that the war was not necessarily a failure, but was
right.
Certainly not a success. The war did accomplish a number of things, but how lasting those accomplishments or achievements are is in doubt. One of the points that needs to be stressed, and I think one of the mistakes that the Israelis made, is to imagine that getting rid of Hamas necessarily entailed fully reoccupying the Gaza Strip. See, Hamas made a mistake that Hezbollah was too clever or cleverly avoided. What Hezbollah has done is it has entrenched itself in Lebanon without formally taking over the institutions of state. When you actually take over those institutions, those are physical places, those are palaces, they're fortresses, they're military bases, all of them are targetable. Hamas made the mistake of actually becoming the government.
Right.
So they had, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to Gaza, but, you know, there are buildings, there are locations.
I've heard.
It's a charming place,
right.
Wonderful for tourism. They made that mistake, and that offered Israel both a kind of a strategic opportunity as well as an ideological opportunity. The ideological opportunity was always going to be difficult because Israel faces this kind of inbuilt hostility to any military action. But there was a real strategic opportunity. I had a conversation with a person I can only describe as a senior military intelligence official. An authority, let us say. And he said something that I found absolutely amazing. He said they deliberately decided not to target people like Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas prime minister. They went after the security apparatus. They went after the head of the interior ministry and of their police forces, military, but they didn't go after the political leadership because they wanted to keep, they actually thought that there were some advantages to keeping Hamas weakened, but keeping it in power. They didn't want to, and again, they thought that the only way of getting rid of them was an occupation. That's simply not the case. You could have targeted people like Haniyeh. You could have created opportunities for Fatah to come back into power. You could have gone into the Gaza Strip briefly. You could have cut the Gaza Strip in half without actually going into Gaza City. I mean, there are a variety of options on the table that they decided not to pursue. And this led to the kind of even deeper mistake that they made, which was the idea that it's in Israel's advantage to keep the Palestinian Authority riven between Fatah in Ramallah and Hamas in the Gaza City. And this is a kind of, it's a peculiar kind, if I may say, criticize Israel. There's a peculiar kind of arrogance there. It was the same arrogance of Rabin who thought that, you know, if you had Arafat in Ramallah, he would take care of these rioting Palestinians, and he wouldn't have B'Tselem and these Israeli human rights groups breathing down his neck. Well, that turned out to be a very serious mistake. It's always very foolish to think that you should bring in some thug, you know, John Gotti, right, to do your police work, because you end up empowering these characters and they become problematic. It's that much more problematic because what Israel was able to accomplish now in Gaza was done when Hamas did not have the implicit nuclear umbrella of Iran. That may not always be true. If in 3 years Iran is a nuclear weapon state, Israel's military options vis-a-vis Hamas and vis-a-vis Hezbollah will be constrained by the possibility that Iran may insert itself or that there may be an escalation that could be devastating. And that, too, is something that the Israelis, I think, should have considered more carefully.
So that brings us to... we will, eventually. We'll get around to it. We'll talk the economy and things will...
Oh, yeah.
The New York Times this morning had a story that we talked about a little bit before, that Hillary Clinton has come to the conclusion that negotiations with Iran won't halt their nuclear program. No, really, she came to that conclusion. So I'm not sure what it didn't say, and what I suppose it couldn't say, is what we learned to call in Talmud the nafka mina. That is, what's the moral that you get from that? What comes out of that? It certainly didn't come anywhere close to saying that, therefore, they would consider any sort of military option. I saw the name Sarkozy at the end of the article, but as though some kind of European alliance might succeed. But what do you think the administration's conclusion is going to be? And if you had to guess, what do you think Israel will do, if anything?
First of all, the moral of the story is you shouldn't read the New York Times. Second of all, I'll be selling subscriptions to the journal in the back. So just consult.
There are too many numbers in the journal. It's all these numbers. I like words.
The Bush administration, where my sources were probably rather better developed than they are now, was a bit of a... Its policy vis-a-vis Iran was an absolute mystery. On two occasions when I met with the president himself, President Bush, and the issue of Iran came up, he was remained absolutely silent. He was very reluctant to address the issue. I don't want to offer predictions either invidious or hopeful about the Obama administration, because it is still an administration that is finding its way and 1 month or so into its term. So I think there's a kind of aspect of unfairness. Look, I was heartened by Clinton's comments because it was obeying one of my commandments. So clearly she was channeling my I don't know, what was she channeling?
But Your spirit.
It's important, and it showed a welcome sense of realism, as well as about Iran, as well as an awareness of the way in which Iran has played the Europeans and the Russians and the UN and the rest of the international community for dupes and fools for the past 5 years. It raises the question, if she thinks the prospects of a successful negotiation are dim, why are they pursuing it at all? And the best answer that can be given on her behalf is that if you are seriously considering a military option, you have to show your own people, you have to show the American people that you have gone the last mile. And that there is no other alternative. And in that sense, it potentially strengthens the case for a military option. Now, is the Obama administration seriously considering a military option? I don't know. I suspect not. What I hope they're considering is, in the great, moral of lead, follow, or get out of the way, that they will seize on that third point, get out of the way, if Israel decides to strike Iran. And if Israel decides to strike Iran, it will happen this year.
Well, there were stories, at the end of the Bush administration, that the Bush administration had blocked or rejected proposals from Israel.
Yeah, you read that in the New York Times.
Never mind. That's only because the LA Times doesn't cover any news, so you have to read something somewhere.
There is an alternative. Look, that story was a problematic story.
USA Today subscriptions will be available now.
That was a problematic story. I mean, one thing it got flatly wrong was this. It spoke of this kind of mystery bunker-busting bomb which the Israelis had requested, and the U.S. decided not to give. And to the best of my knowledge, that whole story was false. There is no sort of super-duper bunker-buster that, you know, has been developed in the bowels of, you know, the Lockheed Corporation or wherever that, maybe some of you work for Lockheed and can give me the answer. So I think that aspect was mistaken. A second point, which I think is important, is, look, if Israel decides that it's going to strike Iran, they're probably not going to call up the U.S. and say 4 weeks in advance, we're going to strike on Tuesday, and we need, you know, X, Y, and Z. A, it creates very serious dangers of a leak. And if you're determined to strike, you know, I mean, if you're determined to sort of take your parents' car out for a spin and you're afraid they're going to say no, you just don't ask. I mean, I don't know if that's, maybe that's what you did, but that is, as Israel would say, it's logic. Look, the way it would work is if Israel decides to go at it, first of all, I think there will be, it will happen, if it happens, it will happen in a way that none of us quite expect. There will be an element of surprise, and that might mean I don't know what. It is in the nature of surprise that you don't know what it's going to be. But to the extent that the U.S. is going to be involved, I think what's going to happen is the Minister of Defense, probably Ehud Barak, or hopefully Ehud Barak, is going to pick up the phone to Bob Gates and say, I'm very sorry, we had to do this. It's happening in 5 minutes. I just want to let you know. And that's the way it's going. If it happens, that's the way it's going to happen. That being said, since I think this is a topic which is of huge concern and interest, there are a whole variety of options that do not necessarily involve bombing. And in fact, I have long made the case that the single best thing that we could do is impose a gasoline embargo on the Iranians and do so very soon. Why? I mean, some of you, I'm sure, know that contrary to the myth that the Iranians have us over their oil barrel, we have them over our gasoline barrel because they import about 40% to 50% of their refined petroleum products. They have no refining capability because they've been working on the arrival of the 12th Mahdi. So they've neglected engineering. And sorry, I'm digressing twice now, but you know it is important to understand, and this is a bit on the, I hate to say it, on the optimistic side. Any open society is acutely aware of our failings and our problems. It is fundamentally the strength of our society that we are aware of them, and we adjust and adapt and fix problems as they come. It is in the nature of closed societies that they present only the asset side of their ledger to the outside world. But it is wrong to assume that Iran and the Iranian regime doesn't have huge and pressing problems which can't be exploited by the United States or by Israel. Iran has huge problems, and we ought to exploit those problems, and we ought to do so quickly and aggressively. I mentioned that as a preface to talking about their reliance on imported petroleum products. About a year ago, there was gas rationing was imposed, I think in Tehran and maybe Isfahan or Natanz or somewhere, and there were riots at Iranian petrol stations. Right. And the riots began to get out of hand, and one of the ways in which they started getting out of hand was that people would photograph these riots and then text the photograph over to friends around the country. The Iranians got so worried that they actually shut down the SMS system, or the mobile, I don't know, GSM system, of the country. That's how brittle the regime is, and how fearful it is, and how exposed it is to a sharp, sudden increase in oil prices when inflation is already running at around 35-40%. Now, the argument is made, if we bomb, we will give, as Bernard Lewis says, we will give the regime the gift of Iranian patriotism. We don't want to do that. But Iranians know that their government is in violation of three binding UN Security Council resolutions, which they brought upon themselves, that they have massive economic problems, and yet they continue to invest something to the tune of $16 to $20 billion in nuclear programs they don't need, and that that is part of the cause of their suffering. If they import this gas, all this gasoline, there are two things the U.S. could do. They get it from about four companies. We can penalize those companies. We know their names. Vitol is one of them, based in Rotterdam. There are a few others, I think, mainly connected with Mark Rich, but that's another story. We can penalize those companies and forbid them from trading with Iran, or giving them the choice, trade with Iran or trade with us. Or we can impose a naval blockade on Iranian imports. And we could do it this way. We could say to them, look, you're violating three binding UN Security Council resolutions. The IAEA says you're cheating. You're not telling us the truth. We're blockading your oil imports, your gasoline imports, for 2 weeks. See how you like it. After 2 weeks, we're going to lift the blockade. You have a week to respond. If you don't come into compliance with the resolutions, we're going to blockade for a further 3 weeks. Ratchet up the pressure that way. I mean, the Iranians came, this regime came into power in a very sudden revolution. They are acutely aware of how quickly a revolutionary scenario can arise which could sweep them out of power. And this is the kind of weapon that would be one of the tools at America's disposal if we use it now.
So why in 8 years of the Bush regime was that never, what's the counter argument?
Well, you know, I once asked Condoleezza Rice this question, and to my complete amazement, this was sort of ranked up there with most fatuous answers ever from senior administration officials. She said, well, we don't want to punish the Iranian people. So I said, well, in that case, lift the restrictions on
right.
lift the rest of the trade embargo. I mean, if that's your policy, it was bizarre. Now, somewhat to the administration's credit, they thought, A, I think they thought they had more time than they did. B, they were trying to apply a variety of other sanctions, because this, a blockade is in fact an act of war, so it entails,
right.
I mean, it's a much more serious act than what they had done. But this is, you know, whatever the Bush administration did or didn't do, this is the year of decision. And this is what we have to be focused on now. And a military option is a bad option. It is the second worst option. Which is why I've been talking, I'm going blue in the face talking about this gasoline embargo.
Okay, I'm going to ask just for a couple of questions. I'm going to take two or three questions, but you're going to have many, many more questions than I'm going to have a chance actually to report, so please forgive me. All right, I'll start. Go ahead. Okay, in 2007, when they bombed Syria, there wasn't a heavy negative reaction, unlike 1991. So are they sure that there would be a terrible... Are they sure that there would be a terrible reaction if they bombed the Iranian nuclear facilities?
Well, the cases aren't really analogous because, among other things, the Syrians had never... No one knew about the site. The Syrians never admitted to it. They still don't admit to it now. And so the Israelis uncharacteristically shut up,
right.
Which was, you know, in fact, I knew it was a nuclear reactor. Do you know how I knew it was a nuclear reactor?
You read it in the New York Times.
No.
Oh.
Of course not. Of course not. The reason I knew is when I started calling my usual blabbermouth sources in Israel, no one would say anything. It was incredible. I mean, this is a country which really cannot keep, I mean, they just love to leak. You know, if Israel were like, if Israelis were an object, they would be sort of a punctured jar, you know, just leaking. I say this with a lot of affection
and
love. And for once, everyone was silent. So you knew that was the case. We also knew that the Israelis were responsible for Mugniyah's death when, according to a former report of mine at the Jerusalem Post, the morning it happened, Olmert walked in to the Knesset cafeteria and just had this like unsuppressible grin on his face, not saying anything, but just kind of like this. So that's how you knew. So in the case of the Syrians didn't admit to it, the Israelis remained quiet, and so, you know, there wasn't this great Arab protest because they didn't want to advertise what had happened. In 1981, it was very clear what they bombed. The Iraqis protested to its eternal shame. The Reagan administration condemned Israel's action. Now, what would the world, how would the world react if Israel bombed the Iranian nuclear installations? Well, with fury and anger and claiming that the Israelis are threatening the peace of the world. And which is what, you know, no surprises there. It would be the greatest, you know, dog bites man story ever. But there would be consequences. I mean, that would almost certainly ignite a very serious, very severe regional war. And the region would be reshaped profoundly as a result.
Okay, what about Russia and trying to embargo Iran?
Yeah, the Russians could have been, are, and will be problematic. And no embargo would fully seal Iran off. Certainly not without Russian cooperation, which we learned today from the New York Times.
Exactly, that's right.
Which the Obama administration denies, and I believe
them.
Did
they deny?
Another New York Times correction and amplification. it's a great newspaper. What were we talking about? Sorry, Russia, yes.
We were talking about accuracy in media, which brings us to camera.
Look,
but
you know, one of the things that we're, you know, the famous Churchillian line, Russia is a riddle wrapped in enigma and wrapped in a mystery or something, that to some extent applies today. My own view is that the Russian government does not really operate according to Russian national interests. The Russian government operates according to the interests of the so-called siloviki, the politically connected. You'll notice that when they conduct foreign policy, they don't actually conduct a policy, they conduct operations. That's because they're all former KGB. I mean, this is a serious point.
Right.
They think of foreign policy as a series of operations, and those are operations in the interests of a very narrow ruling class, which has a kind of ideology, but is also kind of an oligarchy. So, you know, the thinking of would the Russians necessarily be imposed to a gasoline embargo on Iran and Iranian retaliation? Well, not really, because it would drive up the price of oil, and they would benefit from higher oil prices. On the other hand, part of the Russian calculus is to damage the United States. I mean, Russia is and has always been a classic spoiler state. It seeks its advantage in a kind of schadenfreude in the disadvantage of others. That's one of the points, sort of, this is speaking broadly, this is what distinguishes it from China. China's rise is fundamentally connected to America's well-being. The Chinese are not salivating at what's happening economically in this crisis because it affects them. The Russians are salivating because in their way of thinking, whenever America is weak, whenever America is entangled, whenever America has problems or is overextended, they see it as their opportunity to score points and to enhance their prestige. And I think that's the way that the Putin government operates.
Always has, way back with Britain too in the great game. They always Okay, yes, but I cut you off. Go ahead. I'm going to one, two, and then we've got to wrap it up. Are you a two-state solution advocate?
Have I ever told you my joke about theory and practice?
Go ahead.
It's a dirty joke, so I'm not going to tell it to you.
I'll go in the other room if you want to tell them.
No. This is not the occasion. Look, in theory, of course I am. It's a sensible outcome. A couple of About a month ago, I was giving a speech in Montgomery, Alabama, to the World Affairs Council of Montgomery, Alabama. And I can't even remember what I spoke about, but sort of Middle East generally. And then mostly a nice reception. And then there's one guy who stood up. He said, you know, you've been here for 40 minutes and you haven't once spoken about the occupation. And my answer to him was, I said to him, you know, no one wishes more than I that the heart of the problem was the occupation. And this, by the way, is a point that ought to be made more broadly. If the problem were occupation, it would have been solved a long time ago. The Israelis have been wanting and asking to get out of the occupation business for more than 15 years. What we have discovered as Americans, as Jews, as supporters of Israel, is that this was never about 1967. This was about 1948. Hence the insistence on the status of the refugees, at which you see kind of manically in motion at this Durban, follow-on fiasco. This is not about occupation. This is about occupation involving Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Tzfat. So, going back to your question, sir, look, a two-state solution is an optimal outcome. It's not one that we are going to have while Palestinian attitudes remain riven with or fixated on destroying the state of Israel, and that's the way they are now. Israel has become a flourishing, remarkable state despite a constant state of tension and conflict with its neighbors. You know, Shimon Peres, no less an authority, whom I don't always agree with, famously said, before he kind of veered in one direction, he famously said, look, not every problem has a solution. Some problems simply have to be managed. Some diseases are chronic, but you live with them, and in fact, you can learn to thrive with them. And we know this in life. This is the case with Israel. People talk about the demographic time bomb, and in a sense, it's real, but it's 20, 30, 40 years down the road. You don't solve your demographic time bomb by inviting suicide in the next 5 or 10 years. You certainly don't do it when Iran is on the ascendant and when it has as its clients Hamas and Hezbollah. There will have to be a fundamentally different strategic situation. We almost had that after the Cold War when the radical Arab states lost their Soviet patrons and began somewhat to rethink their assumptions. But that period was fleeting and it's over. And we're in a new world historic period right now. And until some basic issues are resolved, fundamentally, the issue being the Palestinian and Arab attitude toward Israel, I don't see a two-state solution happening. And that is unfortunate. That is depressing. But I would not urge people to say, let's go for a deal now. Let's go for a deal on some American political calendar. Because that would just hasten the day in which Israel would find itself in very severe peril.
So do you think that George Mitchell's being there is detrimental?
I think it's wonderful. I always think that when you appoint a special envoy, it means you intend to do nothing about the subject.
And finally, rather than take a last question, let's have you tell us what we should be looking for, what signals in the Obama administration towards Middle East and foreign policy in particular, do you look for as an expert in foreign policy to judge where they're going, and what should we look for as we read the columns of the Wall Street Journal each day, as we do? Religiously.
Fantastic, Rabbi. We've only been here 20 minutes.
And already, you're right.
You're already learning. Look, to my complete amazement, I found myself writing a very generous encomium of the Obama speech at Camp Lejeune the other day, in which he announced an Iraq policy that was, finally recognized the achievements that Iraq has made in the last couple of years, recognized the success of the surge, effectively disavowed his campaign rhetoric and agreed to honor the agreements made with the Iraqis, particularly the status of forces agreement, and to do so by maintaining a sizable transitional force there. I think that's a very good sign and praise where praise is due. A second sign will be the speed with which negotiations, if they're conducted at all, are conducted with Iran. We've gotten to a moment where time really is of the essence, and the Iranians are going to play for it. And the Obama administration has to be very clear that if certain conditions aren't met, and aren't met quickly, it will lead to extremely punitive sanctions and a heightened, a more credible threat of potential military force. We need, I should modify my comment about Mitchell somewhat, only in reference to Dick Holbrooke, who's a more effective diplomat. We do need to start thinking through policy options vis-a-vis Egypt and Pakistan. You know, Eisenhower famously said, plans are useless, planning is essential. We need to start the planning about what some of the scenarios that could unfold there. And we'll be hearing signals from Petraeus, from Holbrooke, and from hopefully someone is thinking about Egypt as well. It will be important. I was distressed by this call that Israel end its, you know, quote unquote blockade of Gaza. At a minimum, it would have behooved the Secretary of State to say not just Israel, but Egypt, because contrary to widespread perception and total geographic illiteracy on the part of readers of the New York Times, yourself excluded, Gaza has two borders, and the Egyptians have imposed every bit as much a blockade and every bit as justifiably as the Israelis have. It's important to contain Hamas. It's important not to allow Hamas to get away from the consequences of its policies, which above all entail the ruin of large parts of their city due to firing rockets. So that was a signal of some worry. Look, in the Clinton years, the pattern tended to be that Israel was always the one that was expected to make the big concession. The expectations were always on that side and not with Arafat, not with the Arab interlocutors. That has to change. You can't simply lean on the Israelis because you know that the Israelis, being the good guys, are likelier to capitulate or to concede. Part of the nature of any true alliance or any true friendship is that you don't extract concessions from your friends in order to hand them over to your potential or your real adversaries. So that's another signal. The list is fairly long. Now I should say, look, again, we are 1 month and how many days into the Obama administration. I think the administration is learning that it wasn't going to just come in, announce that I'm not, you know, President Obama wasn't going to say, hey, I'm not George Bush, and everyone's going to say, right, you know, Mazal Tov and wonderful, and he's finding this out with the Russian truculence, with Iranian truculence, and throughout the region. But the administration's learning curve is going to be steep, and it needs to be short, because as I said, I think 2009 is going to be a year of decision in the region, and what happens now will be remembered in the way that the world remembers 1939 or 1945 or 1967, but we don't much think about certain years, some of the years in between.
First of all, I want to remind you that even in the unlikely event that you don't subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, read Bret Stephens online, you should do so. But also, I want to thank you so much for being here tonight. And before we conclude, I once again want to call on Talia Shulman-Gold to talk about camera, without whom we could not have had this joint presentation tonight. And as we welcome her, let's also give a big hand to Bret Stephens, our guest speaker.
again, thank you, Brett, for such an informative and wonderful presentation. I just wanted to give you a little bit more information about CAMRA and offer you a story that CAMRA monitored recently and what they did about it and what you can do to help in the fight against inaccurate, distorted information propagated in the media about Israel and the Middle East. It's really refreshing to get an accurate account of the events surrounding the Gaza war because so much misinformation is out there. The Associated Press earlier this year during the Gaza war reported that Israeli shelling had completely wrecked to ashes the Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City. And the Times of London reported that 500 patients had to be evacuated during the night because of it. That basically the hospital was flattened. Well, it turns out that in fact, the International Committee of the Red Cross, which can hardly be accused of pro-Israel sympathies, reported that what was actually bombed was the warehouse next door, not the hospital. And the Associated French Press further reported that in fact there had been furious fighting between Palestinian fighters, Hamas, and Israelis during that time, and that Palestinians were actually using mortars. And mortars with white phosphorus, which indicated that it could have very well been those shellings from the mortars that destroyed the warehouse. And so CAMRA monitors these kinds of stories because when these kinds of stories come out, it has a profound effect on people's perception about Israel. And I want to make clear that CAMRA is a nonpartisan organization. They do not take any political position regarding the Arab-Israeli conflict. They don't oppose or support any type of policy by the Israeli government. But what they do is demand that the facts be presented accurately, because no matter what type of position you take regarding the Israeli-Arab conflict, you can't have a meaningful discourse about it. You cannot have an intelligent discussion about the solutions to this problem unless you have the facts at hand. And so that is what CAMRA demands. And this is just one example of the type of information that CAMRA monitors. There was also another story. Professor Rashid Khalidi, who is a Columbia University professor, wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times in which he disseminated a false quote about former Chief of Staff Moshe Yaalon. Well, if CAMRA had not been monitoring this type of story and had not presented documentation clearly showing that this was false, that in fact Moshe Yaalon never made such a quote, and I will read to you the quote that he's alleged to have made. "The Palestinians must be made to understand in the deepest recesses of their consciousness that they are a defeated people." Well, he never made that comment. This comment, this quote, was apparently extracted from an interview that he had with Ari Shavit in Haaretz magazine in August 30th of 2002. It was never, ever included in that interview. And so CAMRA pointed it out to the editor, and the editor included an editor's note saying, in fact, that the quote should have never been included in the op-ed piece. So this is the kind of work the CAMRA does. Very crucial, very important, because essentially public perception will influence policy making in the Middle East and in Israel. And I encourage you, highly encourage you, to look at CAMRA's website, www.camra.org. You will see a whole flurry of stories that CAMRA has identified as being inaccurate or which misrepresents the facts and really challenges the editors, publishers, and producers to correct those errors and correct those facts. And you too can make a difference. CAMRA has an email letter writing campaign which you can organize in your community. And essentially, what you need to do is to monitor the newspaper, monitor periodicals, monitor television reports, and then And then call up the editors, write letters, call up the editors and tell them, in fact, that this is inaccurate and must be retracted or corrected. CAMRA can give you the resources. We can help you in forming this letter writing campaign. And I can promise you that if enough people band together, monitor these inaccurate, distorted stories and demand that the editors refute them and publish the corrections, it will make a difference in public perception, and it will ultimately affect the policies connected to Israel and the Middle East. So I just wanted to say that there's information in the back at the table, more information about CAMRA. Our board member, Lana Melman, is here, and she and I will be happy to answer any questions you may have about CAMRA. We're having a wonderful program later in March, a screening of the film based on Alan Dershowitz's book, The Case for Israel. And I highly encourage you to attend. It should be a really informative program. It's going to be followed by a lecture by Middle East scholar Michael Oren. And we have a whole slew of other events, too, that I strongly urge you to look into. Thank you very much for attending, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.